This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Mainstream media tells you the Paris Climate Summit was a deal to save the ages. For a different take, we've reached regular Radio EcoShock contributor Paul Beckwith. He's the scientist studying and teaching climate science in Canada at the University of Ottawa. Paul was just in Paris, in the streets and in meeting halls, but now he's in Norway. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Alex.
Well, later I'm going to ask you why Norway, but my big question for now is, what are your impressions and takeaways from the COP21 climate talks in Paris, December 2015?
I'm very encouraged with what I saw in Paris. It doesn't go far enough, we know that, but I think it really does get the ball rolling, something which the previous 20 COP did not do. And getting the ball rolling in Paris, you know, being a major, you know, European city, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes with diplomats, with negotiators, with policymakers in different countries. There seems to be a different atmosphere. There was some sense of the importance and the urgency. And I think it's because people's wallets all over the planet are starting to be affected a lot by climate change. It's becoming very important for economies and countries financially to take climate change seriously. You know, I don't think that the politicians and policymakers, most of them, are quite to speed on, you know, Arctic sea ice decline and the risk of methane coming up. But they are tying the extreme weather events that we're seeing around the world to climate change. So they're recognizing that, hey, we've only had a degree of warming in the planet and we're already getting these severe events. And you have people like in the Stern report saying that a certain percentage of global GDP will be required to fight climate change. And the longer we leave it, the worse it becomes. And him saying that he thinks he underestimated the rate at which climate change was occurring and things like that. I was very encouraged by all of this.
But James Hansen was not. He says this voluntary approach has never worked before, so why would it work now? I just wonder, it took us, Paul, about 25 years to take climate change seriously, and I don't see tools built into this agreement to actually do very much. Am I wrong on that?
Well, James Hansen would be unhappy with anything less than a global fee on carbon, a fee and dividend approach to carbon on a global basis. So if the countries agreed, okay, we'll put a fee on carbon of, say, you know, start off at $10 or $20, $30 a ton, and increase it every few years after reevaluation, and have a dividend being returned back to the people, which is what the group Citizens Climate Lobby, you know, many people in the public have joined this group, and this is what they've been pushing. And I think most economists that actually study the problem recognize that's the best thing to do. So we haven't seen that yet. But the ball has started to roll. Like, people in finance are talking about climate change being a serious issue. If listeners haven't seen the speech a couple of days before the end of COP by John Kerry talking about how the military is recognizing the risks and climate change is the most important, the most severe issue that the world has to face. And you have, of course, the Pope saying the same thing. You have other people saying the same thing, scientists saying the same thing. So I think probably my expectations of what could happen in Paris are a lot lower than Hansen's. Like I say, I think Hansen is seeing black and white. You know, no carbon fee and dividend, therefore failure of the conference. What I'm seeing is the global ball is starting to roll down the hill, and it will only pick up speed. Like, to give you an idea, the EU preparation for the Paris conference, it involved 90,000 diplomats in numerous countries in the EU and also outside the EU. So there's tremendous diplomatic momentum that will occur after Paris. I mean, Paris is not the be-all and end-all. It just got the talks going, and it got some sort of agreement. And it's like, we may look back. You never know when there's a tipping point when it happens, generally. It's only looking in the rearview mirror that you see that. And so what's happening coming up this year is climate change is definitely on the agenda for all 2016 multilateral events, because we have the World Economic Forum coming up in 2016. We have a G7 meeting in 2016. We have a G20 meeting, and there's follow-up meetings to Paris, and the UN is holding numerous meetings, and there's energy strategy and diplomacy and bilateral partnerships with China, Latin American, and the U.S. There's all these things going on, and all of these things will now go on given that Paris has happened and that agreements have started. So I think that we'll see the ball rolling faster and faster, especially if we are undergoing abrupt climate change, which I've been saying that we have for quite a while. Then I think we'll start seeing these abrupt changes in human response. I've talked about the human tipping point. One cannot say that it's occurred yet, but I think maybe 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we'll be able to say that it did occur if it does in fact occur. So, you know, Paris is only the beginning. It's not the end, but we're certainly in a much better position globally on policy and so on than we were 3 weeks ago, say, before the Paris meeting, I would argue.
So is this agreement giant and complex, or are there layers in it that we should understand? Is there anything you'd like to talk about what was actually agreed on?
The Conference of Parties, it involves all the parties of the world, and the parties are the different countries. So there were 196 or something. There were, you know, maybe 4 or 5 or something like that weren't involved, you know, small countries or for whatever reason. But they had these intended nationally determined contributions. So this is what they say they're trying to achieve. But see, I think what happens is, I mean, what I understand is, you know, if a country opts out of what they're saying they can do, if they're not making an honest effort to try it, then I think that country will be hurt. Like, their global standing will be hurt. They'll kind of be ridiculed by the other countries. Their economies will suffer. They're developing countries, for example. There's tremendous money that will be going into climate finance before 2020. Like, there's, I saw the number 100 billion, and then, in Kerry's speech, he was talking about 80 billion from the U.S. or something, and he said that was going to be doubled. I mean, look, how many other COPs have had the Mark Carneys of the world debating with Michael Bloomberg's of the world about climate and investment, and with Tom Steyer sitting in the front row, and, you know, and Bill Gates and multi-billionaires, Musk and other people, you know, attending the conference, taking a big role, attending the sessions on investment and climate change, you know, each going up and saying things. Watch the facial expressions, watch what the reaction, you know, how people are speaking, like Kerry and Gates and Musk and others when they're up. And if you can read people, it seems that these people are really starting to get concerned about the rapid changes that are happening, because the changes that we're observing in the climate system are invariably happening much faster, with much more serious implications than the IPCC documents would tend to show. I don't know for sure. I mean, I haven't been to all of the COPs. I mean, I went to Lima last year, and Paris is my second one. And judging from the meetings that were occurring in Paris, it was like night and day compared to Lima. And also, you know, Lima being in Peru, sure. I mean, if we had exactly the same, this year it wasn't in Paris, it was in, say, I mean, next year it's in Morocco, if it was in, you know, a different country, but it's in the heart of Europe. The city got on board, the whole city of Paris got on board. You know, you ride on their buses, which are super green. They have all these green initiatives. There were over 100 mayors from major cities across the world that were at Paris. There were side events on climate change affecting the global food supply. There were side events on climate change and health. And it was packed with medical doctors from top medical institutions and countries around the world talking about how it's very underestimated, the impacts of climate change on humans, not just on diseases and things, but also on mental stability, mental health, you know, well-being, things like that. There was a separate session on climate change in the aviation industry. And there's a whole group that's been around for a while, you know, just looking at how to reduce emissions in aviation. And, you know, they say things like 20 years ago when a flight would use so much carbon and we're using half as much now 20 years later. And one of the things is bigger planes, you know, carrying more people, you know, which is a more efficient way to do it. Same thing with the shipping industry. So the shipping industry, you know, a lot of the ships are dirty, polluting. And you can see the trails from the ships for hours and hours or days after the ship's gone by. You know, these two industries were left out. I mean, those emissions weren't associated with any country before, but now they're being incorporated. So it seems that people are getting a lot more serious about dealing with the issue. And I think there's only one reason for that. And that is because we're undergoing abrupt climate change and the climate system is going to hell. And we're seeing all of the, you know, threats to food supply. We're seeing droughts places. We're seeing more and more cities succumbing to the climate casino, the negative aspects of the climate casino, like being flooded out or something. There's an enormous economic impact on infrastructure, and it's happening now. It's not happening 20 years or 50 years or 100 years in the future. It's not happening with our grandkids. It's happening right now.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith about the COP21 climate summit in Paris. Paul, you mentioned Bill Gates, and I know you, as a member of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, feel that we should take some technological action to save what's left of the ice system in the Arctic. How did you take Bill Gates' announcement, and how does that work into what you may be up to in Norway?
There's no question. The COP is all about reducing emissions, so it's how quickly do we need to do it. The idea is stay below the target of 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. Although I think that is the wrong target. I think the target should be more, okay, we've had 1 degree already and we have a big temperature imbalance between the equator and the Arctic, and that's throwing off the jet streams and it's throwing off the ocean current and it's causing the extreme weather events. So those things need to be considered more, and is there a way to correct that imbalance? So I was talking about a three-legged bar stool, and zeroing emissions, if we want to stay below 2, we need, without doing anything else in terms of CDR, carbon dioxide removal, or solar radiation management, if we want to stay under 2 degrees, we have to zero emissions by 2050. That was kind of the conclusion. If we want to stay below 1.5 degrees, we have to zero emissions by 2030. But, you know, is that physically possible to do? Probably not, in which case we have to aim at zeroing emissions as much as possible, but that's only one leg of the stool. You need three legs on a bar stool for stability. So the second leg is CDR, carbon dioxide removal. 400 ppm is too high. We're threatening the food chain in the ocean. The ocean acidification is going to take out phytoplankton, which will mess up the entire food chain, and we threaten mass extinction in the ocean, which would then go to land if we continue to operate even at the level that we're at. So 350 now is all founded on the premise of getting down to 350. James Hansen says we need to get down to 350. When I talked to James Hansen and Jason Box and other people and said, well, look, okay, we zero emissions. We're not going down to 350. We need carbon dioxide removal. And James Hansen came back and said, well, he thinks that the natural sinks on the Earth would be large enough to actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere if we zeroed emissions. I mean, I happen not to agree with that. And Jason Box was also saying similar things. So these people, they just don't want to say that word, CDR. They don't want to say that dreaded geoengineering word, but that's the second leg of the stool. And the third leg is the solar radiation management, because we risk losing sea ice by 2020. If we lose sea ice by 2020, And the snow cover is also in the spring is also dropping at an even faster rate than the sea ice. And they're both trending down almost exponentially to zero. And if you just see a trend based on 30 years of data down to zero in 4 or 5 more years, I mean, if there's a turnaround, great. If there's not, we lose sea ice. And if we lose sea ice, then, you know, it would be for maybe a week or two the first year, and then it would extend to several months within a few years, and it would extend to year round. Then we have huge increases in Greenland ice melt. We have a complete change in the Arctic ecosystem. We have methane emissions coming up from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf in the Kara Sea. And there was a recent paper showing mounds. These Pingo, these methane craters in Siberia have an analogous form under the ocean. And what we're seeing is big mounds appearing in the Kara Sea, these massive mounds, which are probably pressure from the methane hydrate thawing underneath, pushing them up. So we're playing with fire here. So this is what AMEG has been saying at least 4 years. So we need to try to cool the Arctic to ensure that the carbon stays in place. And we know how to do this. And we're looking at a non-intrusive ways like marine cloud brightening, but that takes time to develop. We're looking at simple, quick and dirty fixes, which is taking some of the sulfur from a power plant that would spews sulfur into the lower atmosphere and putting that sulfur into the upper atmosphere over the Arctic in the summer to cool the region to ensure that we don't lose sea ice and snow cover and that the methane stays in place. So the stool, I'm arguing that all these aspects of the stool are required, no matter how unpalatable people think this may be, because I would argue you cannot be against CDR or against SRM. If you're going to be against those, you need to convince people that if we do nothing, that we're not going to get tremendous increases in extreme weather events, that we're not, that the sea ice is going to stay and we have time to do all of these other things, because you can't just be against something if you don't talk about, you need to talk about the pros and cons. So if we don't do some of these things I'm saying we need to do, then we're going to not enjoy the planet that we end up having.
Paul Beckwith, tell us what you're up to in Norway.
Okay, so in Norway, I'm co-founding a startup company. The name is Gaia Engineering. And we've been working for quite a while up to now. I haven't met the people that I'm co-founding this with apart from over social media, over Skype calls, et cetera. But we have some ideas that we think we can use to transition the skills of people in Norway. There's 300,000 people in Norway directly in the oil industry. The government has taken a big chunk of oil revenue and has built up the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is $1 trillion. It's interesting because Canada has taken all the flack for the oil sands and tar sands. Everybody in the world knows about the dirty oil from Canada. And Norway, you know, they're getting its conventional oil from their rigs off sea, and they have had a much bigger impact probably than the tar sands because they're pulling way more oil out. But because Norway is doing a lot of other things that are green, and a lot of European countries are on it with, they're really up to speed with energy efficiency and things like that. They have been for years because fuel prices have been much higher in Europe. But this oil industry, they recognize that it is not going to last forever. And with, you know, they recognize carbon taxes are coming. They have to transition out. So we want to use that skill set in order to do some CDR, develop some CDR methods and some SRM methods to make a bigger impact and get the ball rolling to, you know, reduce emissions faster than they would be reduced just by, you know, we flashing them is fine. We also need to reduce them. So we're looking at projects that will do that. I did a presentation a few nights ago, and it was recorded, but the live feed was no good because the Wi-Fi was no good. But we recorded 2 hours. I was introduced by a Green Party member. Green Party is really big in Norway. And then I talked for about 45 minutes, and then the team for Gaia Engineering was introduced, and then there was question and answers from the crowd. So we had a 2-hour session, and we will be releasing that recording along with the PowerPoint slides that I gave at that presentation. We'll be releasing that on the Gaia Engineering website and Twitter feeds and stuff like that very, very soon. And then that will give people a much better idea of some of the things that I'm involved with in Norway.
Well, great. I think it is the future that some of the money accumulated by the oil industry will have to be used to transition the climate away from their own product, but also that will put the oil companies in a new business and a cleaner business, we hope. That's my opinion. So Paul Beckwith, he's a Canadian climate scientist and super communicator. You can get a lot of what Paul teaches his students at the University of Ottawa from his YouTube videos. Find links to Paul's channel and his busy Facebook page in my show blog at ecoshock.info. or launch from Paul's new webpage at paulbeckwith.net. Thank you again, Paul. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.